American Generals Now and Then.
What we did do in Iraq,
room, frying chickens in the barnyard,
was sit down with some of those that were shooting at us.
On the other hand, we'd stand a damn good chance of catching them with their pants down.
What we tried to do was identify those...
Take your average Rusky, we all know how much guts he's got.
...who might be reconcilable.
You just can't expect a bunch of ignorant peons to understand...
Clearly, you want to try to reconcile with as many as is possible.
No more than 10 to 20 million killed, tops.
You ought to see it sometime, it's a sight.
It's hard to see any flamboyant actor playing General David Petraeus in a movie, but George C. Scott's impression of World War II legend General Curtis LeMay feels timeless. The caricature who won the war against Japan. A new look at Curtis LeMay on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everybody. Wednesday, May 20th. I'm John Hockenberry, joined by The Takeaway's Andrea Bernstein. Good morning, Andrea.
Good morning, John. Coming up this hour, the rules for credit card companies are set to change big time. We'll talk to a finance expert and answer your questions live. Plus, Miles O'Brien joins us with a special preview of his PBS documentary on how your ride to work is changing drastically. These stories and much more ahead, but first, these headlines.
And in the headlines, a new ruling this morning means a trial targeting American intelligence officials will move forward in Italy. Several American CIA personnel are on trial in connection with the agency's so-called extraordinary rendition program. The controversial practice involves taking terror suspects into custody and moving them into other countries for interrogation. Critics say it's illegal. This is the first court to go after the CIA program. The credit card rule change Andrea just mentioned is moving through Congress. Today, the House will vote on a measure to clamp down on companies' ability to jack up interest rates. The bill breezed through the Senate yesterday. Only a handful of senators voted against. The president wants to signed by this weekend. Andrea?
California is in no danger of getting a platinum card. Voters there are rejecting a series of ballot measures aimed at cutting the state's massive debt. Yesterday's special election was no contest. More than 60% of voters there rejected the plans. Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger says this now means drastic moves, including a shorter school year and thousands of layoffs. They're all on the table. The only measure that passed was a move to stop pay raises for lawmakers. Looking at the money news from across the Pacific, Japan's economy is sagging at a record rate. New government numbers show the economy shrinking by more than 15% on a yearly basis. Japan hasn't seen a drop like that in more than a half century. John?
Also in Asia, nearly 100 dead after an Indonesian military plane crashed on the island of Java. And Iran's president claims it has test-fired an advanced missile, a new version of a missile believed to be powerful enough to hit Israel or parts of Europe. The announcement from Mahmoud Ahmadinejad comes just days after President Obama warned he'll seek stronger sanctions against Iran if it doesn't negotiate about nukes. The Dow begins trading at 84.74. The S&P starts at 908, and we're talking about credit card bills. Your bill, tell us the story.
My mother is a customer of Citibank. She went out to tend to her dying mother's last days. While she was away, she missed one credit card payment to them, and her interest rate was going to go from 8% up to 23.9% just for missing a single payment.
Credit card bills and bills of rights. Call us with your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
The ayes are 90, the nays are 5. The bill as amended passes.
I'm Andrea Bernstein with John Hockenberry. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid announcing the results of the Senate vote on credit card reform yesterday. After going to the House to work out differences, the bill is poised to get the president's signature before Monday, Memorial Day. We've been following the developments on the credit card reform bill, and we'll be taking your questions on what this bill will mean for you. Here's one question we got from a listener as this bill has wended its way through Congress.
I notice when I pay my bill, the balance is paid, but yet the cash advance that I have, I can never chip away at that. The cash advance seems to be behind the balance I have. I would like it so the credit card companies, you are actually making the decision whether to put some of your monthly payment towards the cash advance credit.
Joining us is finance writer Beth Kobliner, who's been following this bill in the Senate and how it will affect you. Beth is the author of Get a Financial Life, Personal Finance in Your 20s and 30s. If you are over 40, please still listen.
Absolutely.
So, Beth, there were a lot of yays and just a few nays on this vote in the Senate. So how close are we to actually sort of getting a signed bill all wrapped up?
I think it's going to happen. It's going to happen this week. You know, President Obama said he wants to do it before Memorial Day, and I think we're really seeing it, which is very exciting. And, like, down to that woman, the woman who was just on before, her question was, if you have two rates, for so long, credit card companies would basically put your payment toward the low interest rate, which is good for them and bad for you, but now they're required to put it toward the high interest rate. So there are a lot of changes in here that are really going to help people.
So what else is in it?
One of my particular favorites is something called eliminating the universal default. Sounds so huge. Universal default. But basically,
that's something only big banks
right.
can do.
It's not an environmental issue.
AIG has a universal default.
Exactly. Yeah, right. But what they're talking about is, say you have a Visa card and a MasterCard and you're late on your Visa card. Well, up until these rules go into effect, the credit card companies could not only increase the rate on your Visa card, the one you're late on, but also your MasterCard, your Discover card. They all can kind of gang up on you and raise the rates totally. They can't do that anymore.
Well, what are some of the other things that my favorite is when you pay the bill at 3 and they tell you, no, you missed the deadline, even
right.
though it's due today. Or when you go and pay it online and you pay on the payment due date, if
right.
it's on a weekend, oops.
It doesn't count. Right. Well, Sundays and holidays are no longer excuses for banks to charge you giant fees. The other big one is these retroactive fee hikes, which I think is the thing, and rate hikes that make people so annoyed. You know, you sign up for a credit card, the rate is 5%, and then suddenly you're told a few days later for no reason. You know, the vast majority of credit cards say they can just raise the rates whenever they want to. That's no longer the case. You have to be late for 60 days before they can retroactively raise the rates on your retroactive balances. And that's a huge thing for people. When you think about it, it's fair. You know, where else do you enter into a contract and they tell you it's one thing, 6%, and then, you know, 10 minutes later they tell you it's 20%. Oh, well, okay. There was that mortgage thing.
Well, there's
happened.
A guy named Vinny I know in
right.
Queens.
Right, exactly. Yeah. I'm from Queens, so watch it. Yeah, I know Vinny.
Sorry,
I went to high
Vinny.
School with Vinny.
Are there some unintended consequences in this bill? I mean, I've heard that, oh, God forbid, I might lose my frequent flyer miles, which would make me rethink whether I want to participate in the credit industry
right.
or maybe
honestly,
I'll be charged interest right away?
Sure. I mean, the credit card companies are brilliantly, you know, notoriously brilliant at coming up with all kinds of tricky ways. And of course, they've come out right away and saying, oh, well, this is really going to hurt our better customers. You know, they have to say something. But the fact is, credit card companies want people to have credit cards. Even those people who don't pay, you know, who don't carry a balance from month to month are still making money for them because the merchants are charging for people to use their credit cards. So I think competition is going to kick in. You know, this is America. This was all built on this. They're going to figure out ways to make money out, and consumers have to be smart and shop around.
This is America, and yet it's a place where banks are too big to fail, but
exactly.
the poor can keep playing the banks up
Absolutely.
To now.
Absolutely, and this is playing off of the fact that poor people, you know, people who can't read, you need a technical legal degree, and even then you can't really understand the fine print. The new rules change that. It's plain English disclosure in many cases. You know how long it's going to take you to pay off that credit card, what your monthly payment has to be if you want to pay it off in 3 years. That's huge.
We're getting disclosure in this bill. 12-point type.
Right.
For those of
type,
us
right.
in reading, that's my favorite provision.
Right.
We
the
have,
glass
you can
upset.
Go check out your 8-point type by emailing us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. You can call us with your listener comment or question for Beth Kobliner at 877-EAT-MY-TAKE. And Josh writes on thetakeaway.org, if no usury limits are being set in this bill, I would love to hear why not and whether any politicians have expressed embarrassment about this.
You know, some have been talking about usury limits, but the fact is, I don't know if we want to start imposing particularly strict, you know, that you
what
can't
does that
go
mean,
over 12,
usury limits?
Can't go over 12%, can't go over 18%, no credit card could charge you over 21%.
I see.
And the problem is, if once you start doing that, then people, you know, if somebody is a horrible risk and they don't pay their bills in time, A, you can argue they shouldn't get a credit card at all. And if they do get any kind of credit, yes, they should be paying higher interest rate. The only difference is, and what these rules say is, be fit, you know, be upfront about it. Tell this person, you're a bad risk, you're going to pay 21%, and the person chooses whether to do it or
Beth,
not.
Beth, quickly, that just seems to contradict what you said earlier when we were talking about universal defaults. If the credit card company can't look at what happened over here on Visa to price in the risk of this consumer, it sounds like they are, you know, required by the federal government to ignore your credit score on some level.
Well, it's interesting. That's a really good point. They can't look at it immediately. They can say, because what if you were late? Like one of the callers said, he was late because his mother was sick and he was out of town or whatever.
Right.
There are those incidences where that happens. And because this credit scoring is so immediate, one late payment, you know, should that be able to haunt you for the rest of your life? So the credit card companies could look at your credit score to give you a new card. But it isn't fair that, you know, one late payment on one card means everybody should gang up and charge you more.
I'm wondering, we have a listener calling, excuse me, and you can call in, don't forget, at 1-878-MY-TAKE. This one, maybe Beth, you can answer this question.
Okay.
I'm wondering why we can't have the credit card companies lower interest rates. The government should intervene. What are all these senators and Congress people doing on a day-by-day basis?
I know. I want to get their planners. You know, you want to get their daily planners, their BlackBerries, and see what they're doing. But the bottom line to that, again, is I'm not sure if we're at the point we don't want Congress to start saying, well, you can't charge more than 10% or 12% or whatever the interest rate is, because that will, to some extent, limit some credit. What this bill does, what these bills do, and hopefully will be passed into law, is full disclosure. People have to know what they're getting into. There can't be all these tricks and, okay, we're not going to increase your rate, but we're going to charge you huge fees. It's got to be straightforward. And that's one of the provisions, that they can't make unilateral changes, you know, at any minute's notice. If they're going to change your interest rate, they have to give you 45 days notice. There are things in place here. There's particular things to protect consumers, but we're not there where we want them to say can't charge above a certain amount of rate. Of course, there are five people who didn't pass this. Two of them are from South Dakota because they're the big credit card.
Oh,
you
that's
know,
right.
Yeah.
That's right. Oh, they're interesting.
Credit, right.
That's a great
right.
piece
one
of information.
One Democrat, one Republican. So,
what about credit limit? Does this touch that?
Well, it does in the sense that, okay, right now, if you use your credit card, you go to a store and your limit's $1,000 and you charge something for $1,500, they won't reject your card. In the older days, they'd say, oh, sorry, you know, it's embarrassing, you don't reject your card. Now they don't do that. And the problem is then they kick in with an even higher interest rate above the interest rate that you're paying now. The new rules say that people have to opt out of that. You have to say that the credit card company has to come to you and say, do you want us to charge you this excessively high rate if you go over your credit limit? And now people have to actually turn that down. So that's a really, really good provision that will protect people. But hopefully people are paying attention to this. You know, it comes down to you have to be aware of it. And there's still a level of financial illiteracy in this country that we're not addressing. Mm-hmm.
Clearly, the credit card industry has come a long way from the Jimmy Stewart banker in It's American
yes.
Life.
Yes.
And there was the sense of populist
it's
outrage.
It's a wonderful life.
Well,
right.
It's a wonderful
it's American life.
Life. Excuse me, I'm clearly not smarter than a fifth grader. But I'm wondering, to what extent do you feel that this bill is going to restore balance in the banking industry?
I think that, you know, it's a wonderful American life. And I think that we're in a situation
good.
Now where people are outraged. I think, you know, it's a visceral thing. People think, how can this be happening? I think President Obama was fairly genius in stepping in and saying, I'm going to talk to these CEOs of credit card companies, and then I'm going to make this an issue. You know, he spoke in New Mexico last week and spoke about 15 minutes about credit cards. I've never heard any politician speak for so long about such a specific personal finance issue that affects people's wallets.
You can't raise that right, Mr. Potter. You can't do it. You
right.
can't do it.
Right.
It's the I feel your pain moment. Okay.
Yes.
Don't forget to call us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. And Beth Koblenner, the author of the book Get a Financial Life, Personal Finance in Your 20s and 30s and Beyond, will be joining us at noon Eastern Time for a live chat on thetakeaway.org. So make sure you join us for that. Thanks very much for coming in, Beth.
It's been my pleasure.
We'll be right back. You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Andrea Bernstein with John Hockenberry, and we're talking this morning about the credit card bill making its way through Congress with Beth Kobliner, the author of the book Get a Financial Life. The conversation doesn't have to end, though, because she'll be at thetakeaway.org today at noon Eastern to answer your questions for the extremely well-informed Beth Kobliner. How will this bill help you out? Go to thetakeaway.org at 12 noon Eastern for answers and call us with your stories of how credit cards have hurt you at 877-8-MYTAKE or email mytake@thetakeaway.org.
So there's probably not a more fascinating figure in American military history than General Curtis LeMay. Perhaps you know that he ran with George Wallace as George Wallace's running mate when he ran for the presidency back in 1968. Perhaps you know him as the man who is supposed to have said that famous quote about Vietnam, "We'll bomb them back to the Stone Age." Or perhaps you know that the character of Buck Turgidson, played by George C. Scott in the famous movie Dr. Strangelove, was based on General Curtis LeMay.
Can't you stick to the point, General?
Well, sir, if the pilot's good, see? I mean, if he's really sharp, he can barrel that baby in solo. I mean, you ought to see it sometime. It's a sight. A big plane, like a 52 room. It's jet exhaust, frying chickens in the barnyard.
Whatever knowledge you have of General Curtis LeMay, it's probably mostly caricature. He is certainly one of America's most controversial military figures, and here to re-look at Curtis LeMay, the man who arguably won the war against Japan, came up with the tactics of aerial bombing that really were decisive in World War II. Joining us is a journalist and author of the new book, LeMay, The Life and Wars of General Curtis LeMay, Warren Kozak, here in the studio. Warren, thanks so much for coming in.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And it's great to be back with you. We were colleagues at ABC and at NPR eons ago, but enough about that. You know, this is a fascinating character, and, you know, describe the two or three things, and they're all jaw-dropping, that you need to know about Curtis LeMay.
It's an amazing resume. He helped defeat Adolf Hitler. He forced Japan to surrender without an invasion, which probably saved 1 million American casualties and 2 million Japanese lives. In doing that, he also kills more civilians than any other man in U.S. history. And nobody even comes close, not Sherman, not Grant, no one.
How many?
350,000 is the estimate. It could be as high as 500,000.
And he developed the tactics of aerial bombing that were so effective against Japan and particularly against Germany.
Nobody else could figure it out. They send LeMay there in 1945. It's already late in the war. Nobody has dented a roof in Japan. They can't figure out how to get these new huge B-29 bombers to work. He brings them in low. He fills them up with napalm, and he burns one city after another.
What was it about his success in World War II that became the reason for casting him as a kind of a Edward Teller character, almost a crazy person when we got into the Vietnam era? He is a champion of conservatives, but to most Americans, he was viewed as an unstable character.
That came basically from the clip that we just heard, and that came from Stanley Kubrick's brilliant film in 1964, Dr. Strangelove. The fact is, LeMay was not crazy. He was brilliant. I interviewed former Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara for the book, and McNamara called him. And by the way, McNamara and LeMay had epic battles when LeMay
was. And McNamara used to work for LeMay, right?
He worked for him during the war, and then tables were turned. McNamara was his boss when LeMay was on the Joint Chiefs. McNamara was Secretary of Defense. Epic battles. They disagreed on everything in Washington. But McNamara, to his credit, called LeMay the most brilliant military strategist this country has ever produced. I also spoke with Ted Sorensen, President Kennedy's chief aide,
sure,
who called him his least favorite human being. Nobody is on the fence when it comes to LeMay.
Right.
So does this show something about Americans' ambivalence about war, which is that Americans want to win war, they want to support their generals, but they don't actually want to kill anybody?
Andrea, one of the reasons I did this book, I wrote it, I studied him, what fascinated me was, what is it about us that when we are in peril, we need someone like LeMay? And we were in peril in the 1940s. He saved us. And then once he does exactly what we asked him to do, we turn our backs on him because we don't want to be reminded of what he did because it's so horrible.
Remarkably soft-spoken, General LeMay. Here's from a Pathé newsreel after the first B-17 mission over Germany in 1943. They ask him a question just after he lands.
Colonel LeMay, how'd the trip go today?
Well, it went pretty well, except that it was rather dull compared to some that we've had. There weren't many fighters up, and the flak was just moderate and very inaccurate. But the weather wasn't so good, especially over the target, mostly 10-tenths overcast. However, there were a couple holes around. We managed to get our bombs away through one of them, and the bombardier reports some hits on the target and a lot of them around close to it in the town.
Very matter-of-fact.
There's something actually fascinating there. He sounds disappointed that there wasn't more more flak. There weren't more fighters up to attack him. He is the only general in World War II that fought in front of his troops. Every time he sent his crews on the most dangerous missions, he insisted on flying the lead plane. Nobody else did that either.
And he was in a battle once a day basically for how long?
About at least 3 years.
And General Sherman, General Lee...
17 battles each in their career.
In the Civil War.
In the Civil War, he did one almost every day.
Hundreds and hundreds.
And the battlefield was 25,000 feet above the ground.
Did you find him to be a brave man?
No doubt about it. There's also, in some ways, a self-destructive quality to him that I kept seeing. And the Wallace run is a perfect example of that. George Wallace in 1968 was a racist. There's no doubt about that. He ran as a law and order candidate. That was a buzz term. He was a racist. LeMay was not. He helped integrate the Air Force. Why would he even go with Wallace?
You know, what's fascinating to me, Warren, is that this is the main selection of the conservative book club. So are you prepared for Sean Hannity saying to you, this is an American hero who was destroyed by the liberal media? Is that a new caricature that maybe is going to rise out of this book?
I don't know what's going to rise out of it. I throw it out there. It's up mm-hmm. to people. There are parts of LeMay that I found astonishing because they refuted everything I thought about him before. During the war, he develops a relationship with Mao Zedong. Here's this anti-communist that they exchange gifts, they exchange letters. Go figure.
Hmm. And his background, very quickly before we go, he's from Alabama?
No, he's from Ohio.
Ohio, that's right.
From Ohio, dirt poor background. There were times when his family didn't have enough to eat.
Well, it's a fascinating story, not only about General Curtis LeMay, a character like no other in American military history. It's really a story of America itself. The book, LeMay, The Life and Wars of General Curtis LeMay, Warren Kozak, journalist and author of the book, and join us in the studio. Warren, thanks so much.
And all day today, we're talking about the credit card bill that's in Congress. What are you concerned about? Chip and Liz email us. I worry they will raise my rates while they still can. I have $14,000 balance with a 4.9%
Ouch.
Fixed rate. I always pay on time, more than the minimum. Are they going to go after me while they still can? Call us with your credit worries at 8778-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Andrea Bernstein with John Hockenberry, and here's Femi Oke without an H with the headlines.
Thank you very much. Good morning, everybody. A new ruling this morning means a trial targeting American intelligence officials will move forward in Italy. Several American CIA personnel are on trial in connection with the agency's so-called Extraordinary Rendition Program. The controversial practice involves taking terror suspects into custody and then moving them into other countries for interrogation, and critics say that it's illegal. The Italian case involves an Egyptian cleric taken from a Milan street, and this is the first court to go after the CIA program. The CIA isn't commenting on the case. The U.S. military says that early findings show that between 20 and 30 civilians died in a clash in western Afghanistan earlier this month. That's different from previous numbers cited by the Afghan government, who said that about 140 civilians were killed in battle. The NATO-led force in the region says that an airstrike by one of its warplanes killed 8 civilians yesterday in southern Afghanistan. They say the strike was aimed at a group of militants who use civilians as human shields. Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad says that the country has test-fired a new advanced missile with a range of around about 1,200 miles. This is the news release that came from the Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting. Now, we have had situations before where missile launches have been fatal, or previous missile launches, or sound from archives. So I can't absolutely guarantee that that was the sound of the missile that apparently went off today.
Sure sounded good, though.
It sounded like your tape from General LeMay.
It sounded very impressive. And Iran says that its missile development program is solely for scientific purposes, but critics say the rockets could be used to carry nuclear weapons. That's a look at your news for now. Andrea, John, back to you.
Thank you, Femi. And now in Pakistan, in the Swat Valley, we have a report from the battlefield.
We have always said that the Taliban, the militants, miscreant terrorists have entered Mangora in a big number. And they have created hurdles, impediments, roadblocks in order to stop the movement of security forces as well as of civilians.
That's the Pakistani Major General Attar Abbas talking about Mangora, the largest city in Bunir province, where the fighting is the most intense between Pakistani forces and Taliban forces. According to the BBC, our partners, an estimated 2 million people are now displaced in Pakistan's northwest frontier province as the forces continue their major offensive against the Taliban. For more, we spoke with the BBC's Owen Bennett-Jones in Pakistan, who just got back from Peshawar, the largest city in northwest frontier province, where he was talking to some of the displaced people in the camps and talking to army generals in charge of the military offensive. Owen joined us from Islamabad. The Pakistani military claims that the Taliban are using civilians as human shields. And when we began our interview, I asked Owen what he'd been able to learn about this.
Well, I think there are 2 million fewer human shields than there were because they've left their homes and gone to these camps. So many, many people around, I would have thought around half the population in the affected areas have now left their homes. Many have stayed back because each family might leave someone back just to keep an eye on the house, keep an eye on the land. Some have had to leave those who were unable to be moved into a safer area because they're too ill. There was one family I heard about had a polio case as a son, and they felt he was too heavy to move on the road so quickly, and they left him with some bread and water, and that was that. So there are some very, very difficult situations for these people as they leave the area, but the more that leave, the easier it is for the army.
Owen Bennett-Jones, the population of Peshawar, what's happened there? Has it spiked, and are there refugees and people living with family, and has that created some chaos in the city?
Yeah, well, people have, where they've got relatives in the cities like that, they've gone to their homes and they're sharing, as they do here. There is a great philanthropic tradition in Pakistan. It's within families and beyond families, and a lot of people are organizing to help the internally displaced, just sending truckloads of food and so on. So there's a lot of willingness to try and help these people. But the main thing about Peshawar is that it is, you know, a city that's quite buoyed up, I think, by what's happened, because they've been seeing this Taliban encroachment going on for a long time now, and middle-class families there have been really worried about what's happening. People have been sending their children out of the city, fearful that it's all going to go wrong. And now they can see that there's been a change. The army's gone on the offensive. The Pakistani public have got behind the campaign, and they're just beginning to wonder, maybe this advance of the Taliban can now be stopped.
Owen Bennett-Jones, you have spent a lot of time in Pakistan. How would you say the situation right now feels in terms of its delicacy and, you know, potential for sort of real serious trouble beyond Pakistan to some of those that you've seen in the past?
Well, it is a very different situation, because for the first time in the newspapers you can read every op-ed, everyone now, saying the Taliban are unacceptable, they're barbarians, they're beheading people, They're slaughtering people. It's not acceptable. We've got to fight them. And all this is new. Before, there was much more ambivalence about it. And I don't rule out the possibility that things could revert. There will be a lot of civilian casualties. These 2 million people, and maybe more in the future, will leave their homes. It may be that public opinion, I think it's almost certain, actually, that public opinion will say, look, for goodness sake, let's now do a peace deal. Because I think if they don't do a peace deal, the Taliban, it's been left so late this and so long that it will, in my view, take years for the Pakistan army to complete its mission. Don't forget, in the tribal area of Bajor, where they did take it on the Taliban, back in last July, they said it would take 3 weeks. It took 7 months. That's what they're up against.
Well, Owen, let's explore the public opinion issue for a moment. It seems to me, listen to this and tell me what you think, that the Americans are viewing this as a real opportunity to bolster public opinion as far as U.S. policy is concerned. Here's Secretary of State Hillary Clinton.
The people of the United States are responding to a request for assistance from the government of Pakistan with more than $100 million in humanitarian support. This money comes on top of almost $60 million that the United States has provided since last August to help Pakistanis who've been affected by the conflicts, and in addition to the other funding for Pakistan that we are already seeking from the Congress.
Oh, and before we go, what's the sense or the possibility that Pakistanis are going to see this more like an alliance as opposed to the U.S. dictating to Pakistan, which is the sensitivity we're familiar with?
Yeah, no, I think they do see it that way, and this is conscience money, guilt money for throwing so many people out of their homes. Most people here would say it's totally inadequate. $100 million a month, that might do it. There is a huge amount of suffering here. All the American money has gone into the military, 95% of it. People won't be terribly impressed.
So the cynicism continues, and I guess if there is an opportunity here, what do Pakistanis believe the U.S. should do aside from $100 million a month?
Well, I think that's it. I think you know, the United States needs to show that Pakistan's now doing what it's been asking for several years. The Americans have put huge pressure on Pakistan to do this. They're doing it. Maybe they're doing it late. They're doing it. And the question now is, does the international, not just the United States, does the international community actually care enough about these people who have lost their homes and their land to actually make their lives tolerable in the months or years they're going to have to spend in refugee camps now as they wait this out?
Well, setting out the huge quid pro quo, that was the BBC's Owen Bennett-Jones joining us from Islamabad, Pakistan, for an interview conducted earlier this morning. Owen Bennett-Jones recently returned from Peshawar in the northwest frontier province, where the BBC is reporting that 2 million people or more are now displaced by the fighting between Pakistani military forces and the Taliban. Owen Bennett-Jones, thank you so much.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Andrea Bernstein.
And I'm John Hockenberry. Continuing with the issue of Pakistan now, some would say that the genesis of the Taliban in Pakistan and Afghanistan are from schools called madrasas, Islamic schools that are all over South Asia. Jarvid Sumru is a senior producer at the BBC Urdu service. He joins us now from Bush House in London. Jarvid, if I was a student in a madrasa, and I'll describe your experience in actually being in a madrasa some period of time ago. But if I was a student sitting in a seat in a madrasa this morning, how would my day go?
Well, the typical day starts with the prayers. You wake up around 5:30 or 5:45 in the morning, and you quickly wash yourself and go to pray, basically. And after your prayer, you come back and have your breakfast. Then you go to the classes, learn Islamic teachings and fiqh and fatwa and other courses, come back to your home, have your lunch, and then have a nap for about half an hour or so. Then there is an hour or so for the play time. You go, you play, then you come back, do the second of the prayers. And then you come back and study a bit and get prepared for your third prayer. And then you go out for a little bit of playing again, and then you come back and do the prayer fourth time again. Then time starts for your debate, which is called takrar. Takrar means dispute. So that is a time when the students who've been taught during the day sit down and discuss the issues they have been taught during the day. So that is takrar, and then time comes at the end of that takrar, time comes for fifth and final prayer of the day. And you pray five times and go home or get into your rooms and sleep.
And
so
then
started
all over again. In 2006, you got permission to spend 2 weeks at the largest madrasa in Karachi in Pakistan. Did you end up learning anything aside from what it was like to be in a madrasa? And what is your feeling for the students and what they learn in schools like this?
Basically, I spent a fortnight inside a madrasa to do the documentary. So my prime aim was to do a documentary for the BBC World Service. I learned a few things. Like, the biggest learning for me was that I come to the conclusion that a typical madrasa education makes a person so narrow-minded. They've become so focused on just one aspect of their lives that they forgot and ignore, if you can say that. They ignore other teachings in their life, and they don't learn any other skills which a normal state-educated student will learn. So my biggest learning was that, unlike the perception of so many people in Pakistan and around the world, that students learn a lot, actually they don't learn so many things.
It's only religion?
Yes, most of the time it's only religion. I mean, they learn a few things, like they can write or they can read the local languages, but that's about it. They don't learn anything else apart from the religion.
Forget math, forget history, the narrowness of the madrasa schools. How many students would you say in that region that you were observing, how many students are in madrasa before we go?
Well, I mean, there's thousands in number. Right. There are 20,000 madrasas all over Pakistan, all right, and about 60,000 students learn there.
Well, thank you for that window into the madrasa experience. Jarvid Sumru is a senior producer at the BBC Urdu service. He reported from a Bush House in London. Thank you, Jarvid.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, soliciting opinions about schools that offer students cash rewards for improved grades and attendance records. Is it ethical? Is it bribery? Viewpoints now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Andrea Bernstein. We're talking about that new credit card bill making its way through Congress today. Give us a call. Tell us where credit cards have maybe burned you the most.
Hi, this is Jessica calling from Clawson, Michigan. I'm just wondering if they're going to put limits on how much they can increase the rates by. I had one late payment on a credit card in 5 years due to the fact that I made a simple mistake and paid my other credit card twice, and they raised my rate from 9% to 29% for one late payment in the entire 5 years I had the card.
There's a story. Tell us yours at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Getting out of your cars. More about that in a moment. First, Femi Okay has the headlines.
John, thank you, John. The time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. The Federal Election Commission has dismissed a complaint from labor groups against the Walmart Corporation. The group said that the retail chain pressured employees on how to vote in last November's election. The stores held meetings where they warned employees that Democrats were likely to push through a law that would make it easier to unionize, and the company said that the bill would hurt its workers. The FEC says it was a close call, and the guidelines could, I'm going to quote them here, be interpreted as a warning to vote against the Democratic presidential candidate, end of quote. California voters are rejecting a series of ballot measures aimed at cutting the state's massive debt. More than 60% voted down the plans. Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger says that this now means drastic moves, including a shorter school year and thousands of layoffs. They're all on the table. And the only measure that passed was a move to stop pay raises for lawmakers. Iran's presidential field now includes a couple of candidates with some reform credentials. Three politicians will challenge the incumbent Mahmoud Ahmadinejad in the June election. And finally, fans of American Idol will find out tonight who walks away with the title. Will it be California's Adam Lambert? You say one love. or will it be Arkansas's Chris Allen?
How could you be so heartless? Oh, how could you be so? How could you be so?
The New York Times calls the final face-off a rerun of Elvis Presley against Pat Boone.
Did you vote for me?
I didn't vote. I'm busy. Did you vote?
Well, I was sleeping, but I think okay. I would have voted for Adam.
Okay. You can see the final conclusion of the face-off tonight on Fox. 2 hours. 2 hours for the results. Enjoy.
If you're listening in your car right now and you're stuck in traffic, well, your problem is only going to get bigger. By 2050, there will be 130 million more people in the country relying on an increasingly aging and inadequate transportation system. The U.S. Congress is getting ready to look at a massive, once every 6 years, transportation funding bill. Here's Oregon Congressman Earl Blumenauer, who says we need to get creative with our solutions.
We built our metropolitan regions on an assumption of cheap energy and cheap land and unlimited petroleum supplies, and none of that has proved to be true. So we have to completely rethink the model now.
With us now is our friend Miles O'Brien. He's a correspondent for Blueprint America and has just finished a documentary called Road to the Future, which looks at how Denver, Portland, and New York City are rethinking transit. Miles, tell us how the policies in U.S. History, going back to the middle of the last century, at least, have really favored, you know, the situation that we're in now, where so many Americans feel like one of their biggest problems in life is traffic.
Yeah, the deck is stacked for highways. And this is something I didn't fully appreciate, because you look around at our nation, you look at the cul-de-sacs, and you look at the tract mansions and the strip malls, and you think, there's no planning here. This is a mess, right? Well, actually, what has happened over time, from Eisenhower to present, is there's been a concerted effort on the part of the federal government to encourage the building of roads from the interstates to today. 90% of the money, 90 cents on the dollar, for every road that is built comes from the federal government. If you want to build a transit system, if you want to build a trolley or a streetcar, you get 50 cents on the dollar. So there is an incentive. Yes, there is a big incentive, and as a result, we have a lot of roads,
right,
and we're running
out. What would you do if you were a city mayor?
You build a road.
You'd take what you
absolutely,
have.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That is human nature right there.
So one of the things that you really are sort of looking at is whether Americans can give up cars, and there's such an ambivalent relationship. There are people, I'm sure, that are listening in their cars now. People like their sense of personal space.
Ambivalent.
Here,
I would say it's passionate.
Well,
Americans love their
people
cars.
Love their cars, but they don't like their long commutes,
right,
and they hate
traffic. Could be changing.
Traffic.
It could
yeah.
be. And, I don't know. This is America. We love the open road and all that stuff. I'm sorry.
Let's listen to one of the people that you spoke to in your documentary, Jason Luber, who lives in a Denver suburb.
In the West, people love to drive in their cars. They're independent. They love to drive. And it's hard to get them out of their car. Very hard to get you out of your car. They've tried for years and years to get people to even carpool or force them onto trains. You can't. You can't force people out of their car.
So there was a logical policy result of this thinking in Denver. Tell us about that.
Well, first of all, full disclosure, Jason Luber's job, he's the traffic reporter at a local station. This is a guy who likes traffic. He's the only guy in Denver who says, bring it on, baby, because his job
security. Does he like being in it?
Yeah, he doesn't complain about it. But here's the thing. He lives in one of these huge track subdivisions. Highlands Ranch has a long commute. There's no rail system. There's no bike paths.
You get
no
out of your
buses.
Car in Denver, you're lost.
You're a run over, you know, one or the other, right? And so, yes, he would admit that what has been created there is a mess. And when you start projecting forward, what do? You cannot build any more roads. There has to be another way to do this. And that's why, as this transportation bill kind of comes to a head, there really seems to be a move afoot to, at the very least, change that formula and try to favor transit a little more. And, more important, you got to look at that gas tax. It hasn't changed since 1993. Raise the gas tax, index it to inflation. Think about ways of funding this so that we have a sustainable future.
So let's talk about that, because in your documentary, you sat down with Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood. Let's listen to a clip.
Do you really think Americans are ready to get out of their cars?
Absolutely.
Really?
I really do. We're at a very critical moment in the history of our infrastructure needs in America. We're hoping that people on Capitol Hill and out in the country will be thinking outside the box about how they get to work, how they get their groceries, how they go to their doctor's appointments. And people are thinking about that now.
So this was really interesting to me that the U.S. Transportation Secretary is saying we need to rethink our transportation priorities. You sat down with him in Washington. How committed to that do you think he is?
Probably more than he's letting on. If you'll recall, when he first took office, he floated the idea of a vehicle miles tax, which is essentially putting transponders in cars and charging people for the amount of time they spend on the roads.
And
right?
That got shut down in about 6 minutes.
You might say he got the blank slap from the administration,
right.
If you know what I mean.
I kind of worried if that was the first and last idea that Ray LaHood was ever going
to
have.
Yeah, we had to find him in an undisclosed location. But other than that, the truth is that, short of the T word, raising taxes, there is a philosophical change afoot. James Oberstar, who heads the Transportation Committee in the House, is a big proponent of changing the formula at the very least and taking the thumb off the scales for roads.
When you say changing the formula, you mean changing the whole incentive structure
exactly.
So that roads aren't the incentive and something else is.
Why not incentivize an alternative that is sustainable for all?
And
that's a reasonable question.
In your documentary, you talk about how the former Colorado governor, Lamb, got beaten down by these policies. He didn't want to build a ring road. It ended up getting built. There ended up being all this sprawl. In Portland, by contrast, they bucked the system, they went against federal policy, and they have a much more compact city where you actually found people who basically spend their whole lives biking, including getting groceries.
Yeah, it's an amazing contrast between those two cities. One city successfully stopping the road, the other eventually building this thing, and the way they grew is dramatically different. And the thing that's interesting about Portland, one thing they did, which a lot of people overlook, they created a government which transcends the city, which actually recognizes the metro area and has teeth and could draw a line in the sand and say, we're going to grow in a dense way here, and on this side of the road, we're going to try to keep that pristine. And that is why Portland is a very different place in this country.
Do you think Denver or Portland, in a word, is going to be the future of American transportation policy?
It's got to be Portland. We can't sustain Denver.
I guess we'll find out. Thanks very much, Miles O'Brien. Your documentary airs beginning tonight on PBS stations.
8 p.m. Check your local listings and see us on the web.
Miles O'Brien is a correspondent for PBS's Blueprint America, which just finished a documentary called Road to the Future that looks at how Denver, Portland, and New York City are rethinking transit. Thanks, Miles.
If Portland is the future, maybe I don't have to move there. That actually might be pretty decent. We're talking about the new credit card bill also making its way through Congress today. What headaches have credit cards given you? We're hearing from some of you who have had a problem with the credit card bill itself.
The unintended consequence of this bill will be a tightening of credit. It will be credit card companies not giving as many credit cards to people, which will be a good thing. My only fear is that the Congress will come back and force any company who took TARP or any of these things that they have to issue more credit cards.
Join our website at noon today, Eastern Time. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Andrea Bernstein.
This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Shakespeare, thy name is Gitmo.
That men do lives after them. The good is often turned with their bones. So let it be with Caesar.
That's going to be a tough sell. I don't know a single congressional district in this country that's going to want to say, gee, great, they're sending us 20 Al-Qaeda terrorists.
The evil that Gitmo detainees allegedly did lives after them as the Obama administration tries to figure out how to deal with about 240 prisoners in limbo. Republicans cackle from the sidelines. Et tu, Cheney? On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, May 20th. I'm John Hockenberry, joined by The Takeaway's Andrea Bernstein. Good morning, Andrea.
Good morning, John. Coming up this hour, we'll see how coming moves in Congress could make your morning commute much better or much worse. And we'll explore a breathtaking achievement in American music and cultural literacy.
Really?
No, not really. we're going to take a look at American Idol, which I watch with my fifth grader. She's bored. I like it. Those stories and much more ahead. But first, these headlines.
And in the headlines, credit card rule changes are blasting through Congress. Today, the House will vote on a measure to clamp down on companies' ability to boost interest rates. Only a handful of senators voted against the bill. The president wants to sign it by this weekend. From personal debt to statewide deficit, California voters rejected a series of ballot measures aimed at cutting the state's massive shortfall. 60% of the voters rejected the plans. Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger vows there will be service cuts as a way of dealing with the deficit. Andrea?
A new ruling this morning means a trial targeting American intelligence officials will move forward in Italy. Several American CIA personnel are on trial in connection with the agency's so-called Extraordinary Rendition Program. The controversial practice involves taking terror suspects into custody and moving them into other countries for interrogation. Critics say it's illegal. The Italian case involves an Egyptian cleric taken from a Milan street. This is the first court to go after the CIA program. The CIA isn't commenting on the case. Japan's economy is sagging at a record rate. New government numbers show the economy shrinking by more than 15% on a yearly basis. Japan hasn't seen a drop like that in more than half a century.
That's huge. Fantasy football fans, prepare for this. Michael Vick out of prison. The former Atlanta Falcons quarterback was in jail for funding a dogfighting ring. Still got 2 months of home confinement ahead. He hopes the NFL will allow him to rejoin the league. Iran's president claims it has test-fired an advanced missile, a new version of a missile believed to be powerful enough to hit Israel or parts of Europe. The announcement from Mahmoud Ahmadinejad comes just days after President Obama warned he'll seek stronger sanctions against Iran if it doesn't negotiate with the U.S. about nukes.
Long Beach, California residents had to flee a damaged apartment building following a powerful aftershock from Sunday's earthquake. The latest tremor was magnitude 4. Emergency officials say there's no other major damage or injuries.
Well, under magnitude 4, trading on Wall Street yesterday, it was down just slightly, the Dow and the S&P. Both start trading in about a half an hour. The S&P begins at 9:08. We're talking about the credit card bill making its way through Congress. Got any stories?
This is Michael from Detroit. Last November, Capital One offered me $21,000 cash advance, no interest, and no transfer fee for 1 year. Immediately, I made a payment. I'm glad I did because 2 days before my first payment was due, I got my first statement.
Let's hear from you. More stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. Credit card drama.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
We are going to lead by setting an example for other nations about how we observe civil rights and human rights. We're going to close Guantanamo and restore habeas corpus.
That's Barack Obama on the campaign trail, and here he is right after taking office.
Guantanamo will be closed no later than 1 year from now.
But not so fast. Congress may not make it so easy for him. Democrats in the Senate said yesterday they would strip $80 million to close the prison from a war funding bill, leaving Obama with no money to move forward. The Senate retreats follows a similar move by the House last week. In the past few weeks, both parties have demanded a more detailed roadmap for what to do with the approximately 240 prisoners held at Guantanamo and assurance that detainees would not end up in anyone's own district. Here in the studio with us is Vijay Padmanabhan, professor at Cardozo School of Law in New York and formerly an attorney advisor in the State Department with a responsibility for detainee issues. Good morning. Thanks for coming in studio.
Great to be here.
So what is this about? Why are Democrats in Congress doing this? Haven't they been some of Guantanamo's biggest critics?
Well, there's a lot of irony here because during the time that I spent working in the Bush administration, we would hear regularly from Democratic critics that you need to close Guantanamo immediately. And one of the things we would always respond is, well, okay, we want to close Guantanamo, but what do you do with the people who are detained there? And I think as members of Congress realize that closing Guantanamo means bringing some people into the United States for resettlement, they've gotten really nervous.
In fact, here's Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid during a press conference yesterday.
Guantanamo makes us less safe.
However, this is neither the time nor the bill, to deal with this. Democrats under no circumstances will move forward without a comprehensive, responsible plan from the president.
So what about that plan? Why is it that Obama and his advisors have not given Congress the assurances that it needs in order to move forward with this, which is something he really made a priority of during his campaign?
Well, I think two reasons. One is it's extremely difficult to come up with a plan to close Guantanamo because there is always going to be a risk that once you bring some detainees into the United States, they're ultimately going to be released into the streets. I mean, any honest plan is going to have to involve telling the American people that there is going to be a chance that certain detainees end up on the streets. And I think there's a difficulty in doing that.
And this is because of the techniques that were used, that they couldn't pass muster. Why is it that they could end up released?
There's two reasons. First is, if you criminally prosecute someone and they're then acquitted, what you would normally do, because they're not going to be U.S. citizens, is you're going to try to deport them. But if they come from a country where there's a torture risk where they live, we can't deport them back. And under existing Supreme Court precedent, you can only detain somebody for 6 months that you cannot deport home. So I think that's one set of risks. The other set of risks are people that we already want to release, that similarly we can't send home because of treatment concerns.
So the president said when he took office and he had one of his first executive orders was on closing Guantanamo that he wanted to do it in a year by January 22nd, 2010. What does yesterday's action mean for that timeline?
I don't think it necessarily affects the timeline, but what it means is that Congress is looking for the president to lay out a comprehensive plan to close Guantanamo. And I think this is very important because not only is Congress resisting to this point taking people from Guantanamo, but so are our allies. And they, too, are looking to see exactly what the president wants to do. And I think what he's going to need to do is he's going to need to lay out a system where the U.S. and our allies share the burden and the risk of accepting detainees. And he tells Congress, if you take 15 or 20 detainees, then maybe the French will take 15 or 20, maybe the British will take 15 or 20, and that's how you close it.
Vijay, this seems to me, and again, I'm speaking not as any kind of legal expert or anything, just as a simple human being, this feels so barbaric to me. I mean, these have to be the least powerful people on planet Earth, and people are casting them as terrorists. Don't they mean to say that we wouldn't be releasing terrorists, we would be releasing people who have spent, you know, the last 8 years or so in a situation of some abuse, and however they feel about the United States, it can't be terribly positive. So that's the threat. It has nothing to do with terrorism.
Well, let me give you an example of a particular person that we might be talking about. There's a gentleman named Mohammed al-Qahtani. The U.S. government believes he was the 20th hijacker on the planes. But Susan Crawford, the convening authority to military commissions, has said this man was brutally tortured by the Defense Department and can't be prosecuted. So what do you do with this particular person? I mean, this is somebody who, on the one hand, has already indicated a willingness to hurt Americans. He came, Mohammed Atta was going to pick him up at the Orlando airport. And on the other hand, it's very difficult to prosecute him because the U.S. government has been torturing him for years. And so that problem is one that we need to face. I mean, he's a dangerous man.
Wasn't the assumption that a lot of the hijackers didn't know that they were suicide bombers? They were just on the plane as a part of the thing?
But, I mean, if they were trying to court of law their knowledge of what they were doing, I mean, if they were trying to regular U.S. court and they didn't know that they were hijacking until that morning, isn't there still some liability?
Yeah, they're involved in a conspiracy, and the way conspiracy law works is that you're responsible for the unintended consequences of your actions. So, yes, they could be held responsible. The problem is, what is the evidence that you have against this person?
Yeah.
A lot of it's been obtained through enhanced interrogation techniques that are now being called torture. Well, then it's difficult to use
that
in a court.
I don't object. I certainly don't think these people are innocent per se, but the idea that they're somehow molten nuclear humans that can't be in civil society, that just seems to me over the top.
I mean, one question that I think Democrats and Republicans are going to have to answer is, why are these detainees so much more dangerous than ordinary criminals in terms of being detained in prison?
Is that one of the ironies here? I mean, frequently people fight for prisons in their districts because there's an economic development aspect to it. And certainly there are all kinds of dangerous people who have committed crimes in America that reside in prisons in these districts. So is there some kind of something else going on here?
Well, I mean, Hillman Montana, for example, came forward and said specifically they want to bring Guantanamo detainees and have the U.S. government build a facility in Montana to create jobs. I think, you know, terrorism is a unique threat, partly because it is committed by people who are not from the community. And so there's, I think, a reluctance to want to accept people who are not Americans coming into their community who may have, as you know, have concerns against the U.S. based on their treatment at Guantanamo and may do bad things in the community.
Last week, the White House announced without much explanation that it was going to reinstitute some of these military tribunals. Was that part of this discussion, or was there another reason for that?
It was very much a part of this discussion. I think one of the major ways that the Obama administration is going to want to solve the Guantanamo problem is to prosecute as many detainees as possible. And I think they're realizing that the federal courts are not going to be a venue where they're going to be able to prosecute as many people as they need to. So they want to preserve military commissions as a route to get jail time for a larger percentage of Guantanamo detainees.
So what does that do to Obama's argument that he has made pretty consistently that Guantanamo is an international blot on America's reputation?
You called them a failure. You called the tribunals a failure.
He has called the tribunals a failure, but one thing, important thing to remember now is, regardless of the president, we now know that detainees have constitutional rights. And we also know that they're going to not be prosecuted at Guantanamo, but in the United States, presumably. And so one of the consequences of that is that it's not going to be the same Bush administration military commissions we've already seen, but there are going to be more procedural protections for the defendants.
BJ, what's the end game here? I mean, do you think it's going to be justice in the end, that there's some sort of adjudication that will truth tell here, or is this going to be some manipulated process that in the end is a form of quarantine?
Well, I think ultimately these detainees, as I said, have constitutional rights. And so I think ultimately the courts are going to be the final vindicators of rights for these people. But I think there's a good chance that we're going to end up in a system where hopefully only those who are the core, most dangerous people that were picked up and are held at Guantanamo are continued to be detained.
Obama's going to be speaking tomorrow, the former constitutional law professor. He's expected to outline his plans for the suspects that are still in Guantanamo. What can he say to get his plan back on the rails?
I think the most important thing that he needs to say is he needs to reassure our allies in Congress that people that are going to be released from Guantanamo are people the U.S. really believes can be reintegrated into the community. So I think that's the first thing. I think the second thing is I think people want to hear that he has a plan that is linked to the rule of law, meaning he's going to continue his commitment to having courts serve the primary vetting function, deciding who needs to be detained and who's not.
Is this congressional balking because Democrats are really hearing from their constituents about this? And what does that say about the American psyche, if that's the case?
Well, you know, the Bush administration certainly spent 8 years saying that these people were the worst of the worst, to pardon, to use Don Rumsfeld's term. So I think people are nervous about it. But I also think the Democrats are right to expect the administration to give a plan for closing Guantanamo. Why should, if I'm a congressman from Virginia, should I agree to let 30 detainees into Virginia unless I know it's part of a plan to actually close the facility? I don't want to bear the burden without knowing what part of the burden I'm bearing.
So in a word, is this a roadblock or have they hit the wall?
I think it's a roadblock for now, but I think Thursday is really where the rubber hits the road.
Thanks very much, Vijay Padmanabhan, professor at Cardozo Law School and formerly an attorney advisor in the State Department with a responsibility for detainee issues. Thanks for coming in.
Email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age. Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
We're talking about the new credit card bill making its way through Congress. What's not in it that would help you?
They need to implement
usury laws. They worked before, and they need to re-implement other tough financial regulations such as the Glass-Steagall Act so that banks become regional banks again instead of big behemoth national banks.
Call us with your problems at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email mytake at thetakeaway.org.
All right, let's begin with that American Idol wordsmith herself, Paula Abdul.
Adam, adjectives can't express what you've brought to this show, Season 8.
No adjectives?
It has been truly remarkable.
Well, there's one.
I'm in awe.
Awe's a noun.
You can sing whatever you want to sing, and I will be a fan forever, front in line.
Wait a minute. Getting Paula Abdul to be your fan for life, that's for the winner on American Idol? I need an explainer. And this guy, he's a judge?
I love the song, but if I'm being honest with you, it was like three friends in their bedroom strumming along to Marvin Gaye. I mean, sorry.
Simon Cowell, of course, the unforgettable. The voice is recognizable and iconic as any in American pop culture. Tonight is the night American Idol fans have been waiting for weeks. We're all going to find out whether Adam Lambert or Chris Allen will be the new American Idol. Last night, Adam and Chris faced off in some pretty memorable final performances.
Father, we don't need to escalate.
You know the casting, okay? Adam is the hard rocker from Southern California with black nail polish and eyeliner, widely speculated to be gay. Chris, the evangelical Christian from Arkansas who likes singing to acoustic guitar. Is it a red state, blue state controversy? Is it a battle of the sort of cultural poles of Americana? Here to sort this out for me, because I am totally ignorant. It's Angel Cohn, senior editor of the website Television Without Pity. We welcome her back here to the program, and that's a division of NBC Universal. So you're part of the whole television crew, NBC Universal, which covets the American Idol audience, I do believe.
Actually, at a recent upfront, they said that they would be happy to take American Idol if Fox ever wanted to get rid of it.
Right,
so.
Exactly.
And, John, can I just say,
yes.
It's not a judge. It's a vote. Everybody votes.
No, I know. I know. Everybody knows how this works. America votes. But there are the judges there.
The judges express their opinions, and then America gets a chance to vote. But it's basically a popularity contest.
And dorky Ryan Seacrest is sort of in the middle of it all somehow.
He just sort of keeps the ship going.
Right. Well, let me not be chauvinistic about the whole thing. Let's just talk about these two characters.
Yes.
It is really kind of an interesting setup for the end. I kind of feel that they sort of planned it this way.
They planned it perhaps this way. The final three definitely seemed sort of faded from the beginning. There was either Adam seems to have been the forerunner from the get-go. He's, the edgy rocker, definitely different than anything they've ever had on this show, sort of breaking the mold. Then there's Chris Allen, who's this sweet, charming little married guy, very humble, very religious, has a good little family. And the person that got voted out last week was actually thought to go head-to-head with Ryan. He's Danny Gokey. He has this charming story about how he's recently widowed, and he, raises money for a foundation for his wife. So it definitely seems to be sort of a battle between, the typical American Idol, between Chris Allen or the Danny Gokey type, and then this crazy Adam Lambert sort of person.
And the Latina. We lost the Latina, Alice Narahita. So there's sort of something, another sort of little sort of emerging American political power story.
She was also fallen into the sort of the edgy rocker, even though she's just a cute little 16-year-old kid who probably just does what people tell her.
But the narrative here isn't battle anymore in American Idol. It seems to me that both of these characters are going to have recording contracts. And in fact, the last five in American Idol, definitely get a bump in pop culture somehow.
They definitely get a bump. The thing is sometimes having the title of American Idol doesn't necessarily mean you're going to sell records. Sometimes the people who are the runners-up actually do better recording-wise because they're not tied to having this specific American Idol produced album with the rainbows and unicorns and pretty little songs that they have to sing about hope.
You want to know how ignorant I am about this? And again, I'm not being chauvinistic. I'm just
sure
disclosing.
You're not.
I thought because I just sort of would see it on television screens across the room that Susan Boyle was actually going to be with the winner.
John, I think you're overplaying your ignorance.
No,
she does seem to be everywhere.
She does. She does. So it's possible though that Susan Boyle is going to break up the franchise in the sense that Simon Cowell might depart after this season?
He seems to be gung-ho on the idea of having the best singer win this competition, which is the purpose of this competition, but doesn't necessarily seem to be what has happened in years past.
I feel like the fact that Adam Lambert is so close, whether he ends up being the winner or not, the fact that he's so close and he might be gay, and
right.
the thing that just happened with the whole California Miss America,
right.
where she criticized gay marriage and she was slapped for that.
Right.
I mean, I feel like this really does say something about where American culture is right now.
Right. I mean, it definitely says something, but you still see a lot of people on the internet going, oh, Adam's scary, Adam's freaky, I don't get him. And the underlying thing that they're not saying is maybe they're scared of him because he's gay,
but
they're not coming right out and saying that. They're just saying, oh, his look, his voice, it freaks me out.
Well, but wait a second. It says something, but maybe what you're really talking about is the debate over this cultural issue is actually taking place in the context of American Idol. Do you think that the conversation is actually this conversation?
I do think it's definitely a conversation, and definitely the media has latched on to this in a way. But
we do that.
Yes, you do. Rightfully so. But, I mean, this is the most popular show on television right now. So this is something that people from all across the country watch. So I think it's good that it opens up this debate about, you know, what all of America is watching. It's definitely split into two factions, probably by red state and blue state, but you know, there's the cute.
I'm shocked that it's come this Adam's come this far.
I'm a big fan of his, but I never thought that we would be sitting here at the finals with him in it.
And quickly, what will the numbers be tonight?
I believe last week there were 80 million,
80 million.
Votes.
Wow.
People voted for president, though.
Wow.
Right. But so, I think they might get 90, possibly close to 100.
Watch and see the numbers. American Idol finishes up tonight. Angel Cohn, senior editor of the website Television Without Pity. Now, Femi Okay has some headlines.
Just coming up to 29 minutes past the hour. In Afghanistan, the U.S. military says that preliminary findings show that between 20 and 30 civilians died in a clash in western Afghanistan earlier this month. That's a different number cited by the Afghan government, who said that 140 civilians were killed in that battle. New numbers show that Japan's economy is taking a record plunge in the first quarter of this year. The government says the economy shrank by more than 15% on a yearly basis, and Japan hasn't seen a drop like this in more than half a century. And back in the US, a Navy helicopter with five people on board has crashed into the ocean just south of San Diego. That news comes according to the Coast Guard, and they are currently searching the area for survivors and wreckage. Let's look at some stories making headlines this morning. John.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning. I'm John Hockenberry here with Andrea Bernstein. We're talking about that new credit card bill making its way through Congress today. Andrea, here's a cliffhanger from Louisa in New York, who says on our website, I was looking through my mail and came across a letter that looked like something I should throw away. But instead, it's a letter from my credit card company that said if I didn't reject this letter, my rate was going to go up from 4.99% to 10.99%. I ask, who wouldn't reject such a letter? I was just lucky that I actually opened the envelope.
It's the old fool them with a junk mail disguise trick.
Yeah, I didn't even know they had that trick. Call us with your problems. And what do you want the bill to do for you at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Our guests could probably help out with that.
Perhaps. Yesterday, President Obama announced new fuel efficiency standards for cars and light trucks, raising them to 35 miles per gallon by 2016.
Now, in the past, an agreement such as this would have been considered impossible. It's no secret that these are folks who've occasionally been at odds for years, even decades. In fact, some of the groups here have been embroiled in lawsuits against one another.
But as contentious as the fight to raise fuel standards has been, the new measures won't reduce global warming if Americans continue to drive the way they do. And so an even more controversial measure is on the horizon, the once every 6 years massive transportation reauthorization bill. Here to explain it is Congressman Pete DeFazio, a Democrat from Eugene, Oregon. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
Congressman, the big question that is on everybody's mind who's paying attention to this is whether there's actually going to be a real break with previous American transportation policy, which has always favored roads and driving over transit. How's it looking?
Oh, absolutely. There's going to be a break if Chairman Oberstar and I have anything to say about it. And we've met with leadership and they're encouraging us to move forward. We've really been living off the legacy of the Eisenhower era, have not really substantially revisited our transportation policy except for some tweaks here and there over the last 50 years. And you know, we haven't even done a very good job of taking care of that legacy. I mean, the system's in horrible shape. 160,000 bridges are in need of dramatic repair. Road surfaces are bad. Congestion is unbelievable. Americans waste $80 billion a year caught in traffic. We need a 21st century transportation system, and we intend to lead people there.
You got in maybe a little bit of trouble early on when you were an early critic of the Obama administration for what you characterized as maybe a wavering commitment on transit. That was back, if I recall correctly, late January. Do you think things have changed in the last several months with the Obama administration, or are you less of a critic now?
That was during the so-called stimulus debate.
Are you saying so-called debate or so-called stimulus?
Well, I think so-called stimulus. I think it was a wasted opportunity. There was over $300 billion in tax cuts, which do little or nothing to put people back to work, get the economy on track. And a fraction of that was actually invested and spent in the future of our transportation system infrastructure, which we know puts people to work and we know improves our productivity. We know, if done right, will get people out of traffic and into more efficient options. That was a time that could have been better.
So what's happening now? Do you see the White House as being more aggressive on this issue?
Well, the president and I have had a couple of exchanges over this.
Friendly?
Yes, he's always friendly. He's a wonderful and a very intelligent human being. But the Secretary of Transportation and I have met several times. They haven't raised any yellow flags or anything about what we're doing. They say they want something that enhances livability, deals with these major problems. They are particularly interested in transit, and there's a tremendous amount of work to do there. So I'm encouraged, and we hope. I told the president, I saw him a couple of weeks ago, we're going to give him a product he's really going to like.
So tell us about this bill. What is it going to look like? What will be in it? How big will it be?
Well, it's going to be big, and we're dealing with big problems. The American Society of Civil Engineers and other experts out there, two commissions have all said that, look, the system's falling apart. You've got to put a new emphasis on preservation of the system. But at the same time, you also need to begin a 21st century system that gives people, particularly in congested urban areas, transit alternatives that don't exist today to help them get out of their cars, get out of congestion, mitigate all that waste of fuel and time. And at the same time, we've got to deal with freight mobility. I mean, before the crash, I mean, just ships backed up into the ocean, you know, trying to get their cargo offloaded in L.A., move that through L.A. and other ports across America.
Well, but Congressman, let's talk some naked politics about how some of that might actually be done. Your colleague, James Oberstar, on the Transportation Committee, wants a GPS sort of style tracking system to determine how far vehicles have gone, possibly with developing a revenue source to tax or to have people who drive the most support the system. Do you think people who may have like Easy Pass tokens on their cars and have some of this electronic equipment already in their cars are going to make the leap to some sort of federally monitored satellite system that monitors transportation throughout the United States?
No, not in the short term, and the chairman doesn't intend to take us there. We want to continue to work on the technology. The privacy issues need to be substantially addressed. There's some equity issues because most of the congestion is in urban areas, but people don't drive very far. The rural areas, people have to drive long distances. Certainly you can't have a uniform fee because they contribute different loads to the system. And then if you know where they were, when they were, then you're back to privacy issues. So, he's a little frustrated with the pace of change. You know, he's giving a vision for the future, but that's not going to be a major component of this bill. We're looking at other potential revenue sources.
And we'll be watching for those details. Congressman Pete DeFazio, Democrat from Eugene, Oregon, thanks so much for joining us this morning. And now here are the headlines with Femi Oke.
Thanks, Andrea. Vice President Joe Biden is in Serbia for diplomatic talks. He says that the U.S. and Serbia won't always get along, but that's okay.
I believe we can agree to disagree, provided that we have reasonable expectations for one another. The United States does not, I emphasize, does not expect Serbia to recognize the independence of Kosovo.
Vice President Biden will be in Serbia for the rest of today. A new ruling this morning means that a trial targeting American intelligence officials will move forward in Italy. Several American CIA personnel are on trial in connection with the agency's so-called Extraordinary Rendition Program. The controversial practice involves taking terror suspects into custody and then moving them into other countries for interrogation. Critics say that this is illegal. The Italian case involves an Egyptian cleric taken from a Milan street, and this is the first court to go after the CIA program. The CIA isn't commenting on the case. The military contractor KBR is defending itself against accusations that it did shoddy electrical work on new buildings in Iraq. The electrician hired by the army to inspect the company's work is expected to tell Senate Democrats today that 90% of the wiring was done improperly. And at least three service members were electrocuted while showering in U.S. facilities in Iraq. That's a look at stories making headlines this morning.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Andrea Bernstein.
And I'm John Hockenberry. A few thoughts now about that little eyepiece of the Earth orbiting high above us this morning. You know what I mean. The Hubble Telescope. Beloved of astronomers and computer screensavers everywhere, for a week it's been in the flatbed of the space shuttle being lovingly repaired by some spacewalking astronauts.
With the completion of today's EVA, Hubble is returned to flagship status. It now has a full arsenal of instruments.
That's awesome news, Dan. Thanks. You guys did a great job.
The Hubble, after 7 years of disrepair, will go back to being what it has been more or less since the early 90s. A planetary prosthesis. Civilization's pair of touristy binoculars hanging around our earthly necks as we carry on with our own adventures. Newly dusted off from the cold of space, Hubble's window on the universe is now crystal clear once again.
Out on the high wire, you're a dancer on thin ice. You pay no heed to the danger.
And appreciate all the great support we got from the ground.
Watching the NASA repair team, the Hubble telescope seems to me to be something of a milestone of civilization. At a time when so many voices are concerned about the survival of the planet and dubious about humanity itself,
I'm worried about the human race being extinct by the end of this century.
I just think that human beings, in our arrogance and feelings of superiority, we just roll everything over, we do what we want to do. We need to think more globally, and we need to think about the effect on other things when we do something.
Getting wide-filled into.
With that kind of gloom, Hubble represents another side of humanity. Curious, not arrogant, dedicated to something simple and powerful.
The really great things when you're a working scientist is finding out what you didn't expect. That there's something there that tells you something new about how the universe is made.
Okay, can you hold me with two hands now?
In a sense, Hubble is a Galileo moment for all of us here on Earth. This $10 billion school bus-sized tube connects 13 billion-year-old light to our delicate retinas. And whoosh, we see the universe differently. Just as Galileo did 4 centuries ago.
how old the universe is and how big it is, what there is out there, and whether there are other intelligent beings like us out there. These are questions which all of us ask, and these are questions, the answer which civilizations are judged by.
The one thing I didn't do and should have is I don't have the small socket.
Hey, all of us are Galileos now because of Hubble. Galaxies appear as dazzling storms, exploding stars seem like rare jewels. Our world, with all its troubles, seems a peaceful sanctuary. Galileo himself, after observing the sun and the planets through his handheld telescopes, once said, "The sun, with all those planets revolving around it and independent on it, can still ripen a bunch of grapes as if it had nothing else in the universe to do." Hubble is 19 years old, with perhaps 5 to 7 more to go before it's tossed into the ocean as flaming junk. NASA says the best images may be yet to come.
It's sad knowing it's the last shuttle repair mission for the Hubble Space Telescope, but I'm looking forward to a successful repair and yet 5, 6, 7 more years of Hubble.
Hey, is the universe smiling back at us? Just look at the Hubble images. I'd say yes.
It takes love over gold and mind over matter to do what you do that you must.
You got me? I got you.
When the things that you hold
more of the secrets
fall and be shattered or run through you.
That's awesome news, Dan. Thanks. You guys did a great job.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, soliciting opinions about schools that offer students cash rewards for improved grades and attendance records. Is it ethical? Is it bribery? Viewpoints now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hello, everybody. John Hockenberry here with Andrea Bernstein, and we've been talking all morning about the new credit card bill making its way through Congress. If you're looking for answers, we'll give them to you. You can go to our website at 12 noon Eastern Time, where Beth Kobliner joins us for a live Q&A, so you can get her help on your stories. She's the author of Get a Financial Life. She'll be at thetakeaway.org today at noon Eastern. How have credit cards done you wrong? You can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. A behavioral economist's look at all at this in just a moment, right after headlines with our very own Femi Okeh.
Thank you. The time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. The president wants to shut down the Guantanamo Bay prison camp, but his own party is roadblocking him. Senate Democrats say they plan to hold back $80 million needed to relocate more than 200 Guantanamo detainees. The president wants the camp closed by January, and tomorrow he will make a speech outlining plans for closing the prison. A football hero turned convict is out of prison. That news comes according to the Associated Press. Former Atlanta Falcons quarterback Michael Vick has left a Kansas prison for home confinement in Virginia. Vick was in jail for bankrolling a dog-fighting ring. And in international news, almost 100 people are dead after an Indonesian military plane crashed on the island of Java. The plane was carrying troops along with their families. Witnesses report seeing a wing snap off the old plane. That is a look at some stories making headlines this morning.
Thank you, Femi. So we've got $1 trillion in credit card debt today. We all borrowed $1 trillion, and we're not terribly happy about it. That's what this whole credit card bill of rights is about. So we want the government to come in and tell the companies how to do business, make us feel better. Looks like a job for Dan Ariely. He's the James B. Duke Professor of Behavioral Economics at Duke University and the author of Predictably Irrational. A new edition of the book is in stores as of yesterday. Dan Ariely, thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure.
Now, we borrowed the money, but we're going to create a bill of rights to regulate how the companies deal with us. Is there some psychological dissonance there, or is this an orderly proposition?
So this is not exactly a fair way that you're describing it. It's not really about borrowing. It's about how we're paying for the services of being borrowed, of borrowing money. And the big issue is that the distribution of these things have been skewed very much to getting the poor to subsidize the wealthy. So I'll ask you, for example, do you have free checking?
I do have free checking.
How do you think the companies pay for this? Are they just generous to you? No. What's happening is that there are some people who basically bounce checks. The same thing happens with ATM. The same thing happens with credit card fees. The fees are incredibly high, and what they're doing is they're subsidizing these very high fees, using those very high fees to subsidize the whole system.
And but Dan, my assumption is that because I have a big balance in the bank, they're using interest off of investing my money, and you know,
you have a big
nothing.
Balance.
That's nothing. That's good
it's
to nothing. Know. First of all,
it's good to know.
But that really doesn't pay for it. The reality is that it's the skewed distribution of poor people who are paying a lot. And I'll tell you a story that happened to me. A couple of years ago, kind of that emphasized to me how devastating the system is and how we're driving people to bankruptcy. So I was living at Princeton for a couple of years, and my car was insured in Boston. And I was out of the country for 6 weeks, and my insurance elapsed. So when I came back, I was without insurance. I called my insurance agent, and they said, oh, now that you let your insurance elapse, you're considered to be a bad person, a bad risk, you know, kind of persona non grata. And you can't renew it over the phone. You have to come in person and get a new policy. This was a 7-hour train ride. So after much debate, I realized there was nothing else I could do. I took the train and came to Cambridge. And then I realized a few things. First of all, my insurance premium went up by $500. All the discounts I got for being a good driver disappeared. All of a sudden, I wasn't a good person anymore. The next thing I realized that I had to pay the whole year in cash in advance. I didn't have enough cash. I had some ATM cards, and I took enough money for half a year. And I said, look, here's half a year of payment. I'll give you the next one tomorrow. They said no. But they told me that they had a loan designed especially for people like me. This loan was 20.5% interest rate and a $100 initiation fee. I had nothing I could do, so I took this loan. So think about this day of my life. $500 increase in my premium, a $100 initiation fee, a terrible loan, plus I lost a day of work. Not a big deal in my case, but what if I was on the verge of being financially not managing so well? This could have driven me completely under. And that's what we're basically doing. That's what the financial industry and the insurance industry have been doing. We are taxing the people who can't pay, and because they're taxed by so many entities, payday lending, debit cards, different fees, we're really driving them to devastation and ruin. And that, I think, is actually good for the credit card industry. We're taking credit, we should pay for it, but we should pay it in an even way that everybody who benefits from it pay for it, and not just the poor people subsidizing everybody else's.
How did it come to this? It seems like it's so offensive to everybody's sense of fairness when you think about it, that the poor subsidize the rich, and yet that is, as you laid out, the way the system has been constructed.
I think it's because of the temptation of free. So think about free checking, right? It's just wonderful. It's attractive. So we get all these free services, and the bank is thinking, how do we do that? How do we call something free? And a good way to call something free is to basically have hidden fees and hidden charges. And sadly, these hidden charges are not equally distributed. But I think it's the temptation to get free stuff that caused us to be attracted to these services, the banks to offer them, and then an attempt to pay for them, charge in these incredible ways. And there's also kind of a sense of it in which you say, well, if you make a mistake, if you overdrawn, if you forgot how much money you have in ATM, it's okay to pay $35 for this mistake. But of course, you and I make these mistakes very rarely, and it's the people who barely make it to payday that eventually make up this mistake all the time.
And we're not too big to fail, in other words.
Right. Well, can the government actually do something about this for people too small to survive? Is a credit card bill of rights going to actually address this issue, or is it just going to give us the feeling that something's been done and get some congressmen elected in a year?
No. So this bill, I think, is actually quite good. I'll give another example. The ATM protection that you have, that if you get overdrawn, they're going to respect it. I tried a few weeks ago to cancel my overdraft protection. I couldn't get it canceled. I called the bank. They have no idea to cancel it. So here's what happened.
They have no idea how to cancel it.
They have no idea. They haven't implemented a method to cancel it because it's so profitable for them. So imagine the following.
I'm sorry, Dan. We can't stop lending you money. There's just no way we can do it.
That's happened to me.
Oh, my God.
And here's the situation. Imagine you have $20 in your bank account and your salary comes in today. And your salary is what, like $80,000, $90,000 a month?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, and then imagine...
Mine like
imagine
a steel trap. Damn.
Imagine that you buy a coffee for $2.50, right. A cone of ice cream for $2.50, and a book for $25. Now, you only have 20 in your account, and your salary comes up tonight. Now, the bank at midnight could decide to first clear your salary and then charge you the three things. But they do it the opposite. They first charge you. Not only do they first charge you, they charge you from the expensive thing to the cheap thing. So they charge you for the book first. You went over by $5. They charge you $35 overdraft fee. Then you charge coffee and you charge ice cream. They charge you again $35 and $35. Fraction of a second later, they deposit your salary. Only now you're $105 poorer.
Can Congress keep them from doing this? Can this bill?
Yes.
It can.
Yeah. So one thing they're trying to do is to get people to actually force banks to let people cancel this overdraft protection fee if you want it to be canceled. And then you could choose that your card could be rejected at the checkout if you want. And the second thing is that there's a debate of having it, rather than having it opt out, having it opt in. That by default, you as a consumer would not be assigned to be in overdraft protection, and you can choose if you want to be part of it or not. And that, of course, will change dramatically whether people take advantage or being abused by this particular regulation or not.
Opt in, opt out. You have to have control if you're going to behave rationally at all in this economy. Dan Ariely, thanks for helping us out with this credit card bill of rights. Dan Ariely, of course, is the James B. Duke Professor of Behavioral Economics at Duke University and author of Predictably Irrational. Thanks, as always, Dan.
So we want your stories and your suggestions. What headaches have credit cards given you, and how should the bill give you relief? Tell us at our website, thetakeaway.org. While you're there, you can get some personal advice from Beth Kobliner, author of Get a Financial Life. She'll be on our website today at 12 noon Eastern Time to take your questions about the congressional bill on credit cards, and we'll offer some help. That's today at noon at thetakeaway.org. We're also following the debate over the possible closing of Gitmo. So here's your takeaway.
One question that I think Democrats and Republicans are going to have to answer is, why are these detainees so much more dangerous than ordinary criminals in terms of being detained in prison?
That's Vijay Padmanabhan, a former attorney advisor at the State Department on detainee issues. I'm Andrea Bernstein.
What did he say my salary was, Dan Ariely?
$80,000 or $90,000. A month.
A month. He's
that's
huge.
Right, right? Very close
we
to the
have
truth.
To talk to him.
He's a good
we
guesser.
He's a good
Put
guesser.
Put him on Jeopardy.
Yeah, right. I'm John Ockenberry. This is a much more humble takeaway.
Jerry Houston, more good news for you.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.